You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest of a podcast this week is Richard White, CEO of Fathom.
We're the only people that run all of our own infrastructure outside of the LLMs, and that allows us a huge advantage economically because we know that our costs are so much lower than everyone else, which allows us to basically say we're going to bully all the other competitors by having Fathom's going to set the bar for what you can do on free.
This is Richard. We dig into how he built infrastructure moats that let him undercut every competitor while staying profitable. You'll hear how he spent 2 years on technical challenges that compared the shortcut with expensive third-party services, and by owning your full stack creates unbeatable unit economics. It's a sharp conversation about choosing technical battles that matter, and what happens when you can set pricing rules that competitors cannot match. Well, hi, Richard. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, that was a pleasure when I got the email in my inbox about, you know, the possibility to have you on the podcast. Was the immediate reaction was, I mean, you don't need to explain who this is. I know, because I'm a fan of your software. So I'd love to have you here. And yeah, I'd love to dig into, like, how do you create and what is your philosophy around creating remarkable software in connection to my book as well. But before we start digging into that, what drives you? What do you get energy from as an entrepreneur?
I'm really driven by external validation. I think someone the other day asked me, like, what are some of the top traits you see in great founders? And I was like, almost like a borderline problematic need for external validation. And, you know, it's not really the numbers or the revenue or anything that drives me. It's just like getting messages from people like what you just did, where they're just like, oh, I love what you've built. That's always what's got me out of bed in the morning as a builder, as a software creator. So I would say, you know, that's first and foremost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the moment that starts to happen, it makes you so proud, and it's, you know, you're on the right track, right? That's exactly why I wrote this book, The Remarkable Effect, because once this remarkability happens, something is worth making a remark about. Yeah, you cannot market against that. People just talk.
Exactly.
And do the work for you. The number of people I've recommended Fathom to is, I can't count that on 15 hands. So it's, and that is like the. I mean, I didn't even tell you. So there we go.
And we hear that a lot, which is honestly like one of the most humbling things I hear, right? Where people are like, oh, yeah, I love the product so much, I've been telling everyone else about it. And like, you know, people don't tell their friends about many products, right? So that says a whole lot.
Exactly. Yeah, true. Yeah. So yeah, this, you started the business in 2020. Before that, you founded another business which started in 2007, I saw, User Voice. So you were the inventor of the feedback tab, which is an interesting thing in itself. But maybe I'll zoom into a couple of things that you learned there going forward. But 2020, of course, the year of COVID, it is possibly the best year for you to start, both from a technology wave coming together, because I have been looking for note takers, particularly the note takers that actually summarize meetings, way beyond that, way before that. So was that, how did it come together? What was the problem that you saw? Obviously, that likely you didn't have solved anyway. That way you thought, okay, I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of folks in 2020, I was on a whole lot of Zoom meetings. I was actually doing a lot of user research meetings. So these were, you know, 15, 20 minute meetings with customers, you know, people I didn't know, I only had that much time, and I was there trying to learn what they thought of another product I was building. And so it was pretty hurried. I was trying to get a lot done in a short period of time. And I was trying to make sure I captured everything that was going on, right? Like really like what people loved, what people were frustrated by, so I could kind of analyze that for myself, but also report it back to my team. And I just remember, thinking, gosh, this like note-taking process is terrible. I'm pretty good at it, but like, trying to talk to someone and type at the same time, trying to like hurriedly clean up those notes afterwards. Cleaning up those notes and still finding 2 weeks later, you didn't remember which conversation was which. And more importantly, my like team, I'd show them my notes and be like, they kind of shrug, like, okay, right? Like so much was lost between like me having these really interesting conversations and the three bullet points that ended up on the slide. And it was like, gosh, don't we have the technology to make this better? And there were some companies that were building something like this, but they generally were really expensive, usually just for sales teams. And I was like, I don't think this is a sales problem. I think this is a every person on meetings problem. And why can't we give this, why can't we make this available to everyone? And so we kind of had this insight after doing all research that, gosh, the biggest barrier to giving this away for free to everyone is transcription cost. It was really expensive at that point. But there were also a lot of transcription providers at that point, and they're all pretty good. And so we kind of had this hypothesis like, gosh, I bet this goes to zero. I bet this is a commodity. I bet the cost of this transcription goes to zero. And not only that, like we didn't think anyone wanted a transcript, but we also really thought like LLMs would, AI was going to get a lot better, which in 2020 was a really kind of heretical statement to make. Like I remember we put AI in our product name in early 2021, and investors of mine are like, don't do that. No one likes AI, right? Which is kind of crazy to think about now, but it wasn't that long ago that like everyone marketed themselves as AI products and they were bad. They were like, not well done. And so, but we had this like, I think it was through my network. I kind of knew what people were doing at OpenAI. And so I had a lot of conviction that, like, no, this is going to get really good. And so if we kind of focus on building a note taker for everyone, betting on this transcription becoming free and kind of betting also that, LLMs will get there, sometime in the near future, cool, let's go start building this business now. Because if we wait to when transcription is free and LLMs are good, it'll be a very obvious thing to build and there'll be a million competitors, sort of thing. So that's kind of how we got started. And it's fun because it's a product that I can use myself, right? And so I always find that's a kind of a hack is to build something that solves a problem you know intimately yourself.
Exactly. Hey, you're right. I mean, I was using Otter for transcription, which I'm still using, by the way, but that's another thing. Maybe I should actually completely transform to Feta for this case. But I haven't really nailed the summary part, and it seems to be really hard. And I also, like you're saying, the transcription part is something that it did, and people were happy with it in particular use cases. But for meetings, it's not about the transcript, because then you still have to go through all of it, and it takes so much time.
No one wants to watch a meeting they've been on. No one wants to read a transcript of something they've been on, right? But LLMs are great at that, right? Like, and so they can produce really good output if you tune them quite significantly, as you found, right? Like, I think there is this whole other dimension that in the age of AI, it's all about art and quality of output, right? And not just what the output is. But so there's like a non-trivial kind of challenge there. But yeah, it's been an interesting ride.
Exactly. So it's 2020. AI, of course, is everywhere. It's a big hype for building up. LLMs are getting more robust, and AI in this case as well. There's no shortage of competitors out at the end in this space. Well, at some point there was nothing, and then suddenly there were many. What always intrigues me is like, how do you then differentiate? But maybe the first question then is, what was a very important decision that you took early on that has proven to be, driving the success that you have today?
Yeah, I mean, I think as I mentioned, like we kind of thought if you wait till when transcription's free, basically, and AI is really good, there'll be a million competitors, which there are today, right? There's people popping up all the time. But when we started, there weren't. There were very few. And we kind of thought, you need to start this 2 to 3 years ahead of those two things being true and kind of run at the window, classic, like run at the window and hope it opens when you get there kind of thing. And I'd say, probably the decision we made that I think probably the most fruitful is like we really invested in being a free product first and foremost and making a really good experience for people and not charging them any money for it. We always had this model. This belief that we'd have kind of a two-sided model where we'd give away the product for free to individuals so that we could at some point sell their managers on a different product, right? Like, oh, you want an analytics or insights out of these meetings you're not in. which is different than the like, I'm on this meeting, I want to take notes for me. And we thought, gosh, we know we can make enough money on the manager side that we can afford to give this away for free. And that was, I think, something that no one else in that space was thinking about at that time. And now we've kind of, I think, pushed the competition into having some free tier, but we still have by far the most, majority of our users are using it for free. And it's kind of one of these things where like a lot of folks have a free tier that you quickly kind of run out of credits on or something like that. And we designed ours as no, we're okay if you use this forever for free. And that was a kind of intentional thing because from user voice, one of the things I learned is the power of giving a product away for free. It creates such delight amongst folks when you give them an amazing experience and you don't ask for anything. And so it leads to a lot of the stuff you mentioned earlier, people telling their friends about it, whatnot. And so we knew that there was, kind of like a naturally viral slash word of mouth product here. And if you really want to accelerate, those types of products, you really want to make them free because the difference between recommending to your friends something that costs them nothing and something that costs them $20 a month is very different, right? Like no one wants to recommend something that's $20 a month because your friend doesn't like it. You feel on the hook for it.
Exactly. But of course, at the end, you also run a business. It needs to be profitable, ideally sooner rather than later. So I like your thinking about, okay, we give this away for free, but the bigger strategy is about getting, people to build up the desire to buy something from us, whereby we are going to charge a good fee.
Yeah. And we didn't really worry about that till much later. Like, I was kind of like we're not going to worry about monetizing this thing till we can prove we can build a product people absolutely love and tell their friends about. Because if we can't build a product people will absolutely love and tell their friends about, that's our whole growth engine, right? We don't have a fast growing business. So let's not even worry about, I'm a big fan of like, take all the core metrics, retention, onboarding, acquisition, monetization, and do them in serial. Like, don't try to do them at once. Just like pick the hardest one, do that one first. Once you nail that one, do the next one. And I think that's also worked out really well for us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I read as well. You emphasize reducing user friction, investing in onboarding, and ensuring that the product is sticky and people love it before scaling and monetizing it. Now, making the connection to my book, trait number six is remarkable software companies don't create customers, they create fans. Now, a lot of companies always think, okay, I mean, if a customer is a customer and they pay for it, we're good enough. You obviously have a different philosophy here. So
Yeah.
how do you then start from the beginning with that mindset of people need to love this? What did you do different?
I mean, I think, yeah. So one is that was a key concept for us from the get-go is that, I think too many companies, I think this is actually one of the biggest cardinal sins of startups is people basically launch something that's not lovable. They're like, oh, it kind of works, right? Like, you can kind of get the job done. No one in 2025, no one's getting excited about a software that can kind of get the job done, right? There's so many people you're competing with. And I think, 10, 15 years ago when I was building software, there was a lot of like launch early and often sort of thing, just get out there. And somewhat that's true, but you also only get to make one chance to make a first impression. And people aren't trying your software a second time again because there's so much stuff. So for us, that meant we did a really long kind of like extended like internal beta period where I was bringing on small groups of people, seeing how well they liked the product and really waited a long time to launch and waited a long time to monetize. And was like, let's not launch this thing until I think it took us, over a year to launch the first version of the product. Now we had like kind of beta versions. We gave access to some folks ahead of that, but those were generally folks in my network, people that already had a like high, big relationship with. And so I think it's funny because I don't think we ever thought about building fans, but we did think about like making it that you'd absolutely love this experience. And I remember telling the team, we don't even care. We know we're going to monetize at like T-Mobile features right now, but we don't care about any of that. All we're going to look at is what's a killer single player experience? How do we get you to that as quickly as possible? Time to kind of that value aha moment. And then like, what are little delight things we can do along the way? So like we early on built it up like point system that kind of encouraged you to like do, set up your account, learn how to use some settings, maybe take a tutorial call with us. And the points led to like a raffle. And we'd give one person, one user every month, like $1,000. And a lot of times they thought it was a scam. It's like, no, we're really doing this, right? We would, after your first call with Fathom, we would often send an email to like, hey, we'll pay you $25 for 10 minutes of your time. Just tell us what you thought. So we just did a lot of things that I think kind of delighted people. We set up some emails that would notice if you ran into a bug, and we'd email you and say, hey, we noticed you ran into this bug. We're actually working on this, da da da. And so like surprising and delighting people with like great service, great support, we'll randomly see you're, it's a free product, but we're randomly going to send you, we might send you money just to use it. I think all that stuff kind of contributed to people being like, whoa, what is, I've never seen some of this in software before. And I think that was kind of a really powerful thing for us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you made me think about this notion of minimum viable product versus minimum remarkable product.
Yeah.
Totally different mindset. And it, like you say, it doesn't have to be like a big product, but it needs to do the things that it does really well. And what I also liked about your response here is that you create these moments, these peak moments. And that's what people remember.
Yeah.
And the peak moments at the moment that they don't expect it. And that's possibly even the biggest secret here. Yeah, because when you are just ahead of them, it's like, what? Wow.
Exactly. Yeah, I think knowing where those peak experiences are, knowing like what emotional problem you're solving, because like for us to go, oh yeah, no one likes to take notes. That's the value prop and we'll take notes for you. No, the real value prop is taking notes and having meetings stresses people out. And then they get worried they're going to forget something. They're worried they're going to get in trouble because it's like their whole job if they're in sales or something like that. And so there's actually, I think it's really powerful. It's really fun when you can tap into like a really powerful emotional thing. You realize, oh, when people start using this, they feel better, right? Not just to solve the problem. And so I think really getting honest about like, do we have a product that makes people feel better, right? Because sure, it does a job for you. You might be like, okay, cool, I'll throw $10 at this. But if you make people feel differently, that's where they start telling their friends and you have something that really gets escape velocity.
Let me make a small interruption here. Richard has made a critical remark that sets his approach apart from conventional product thinking. He realized most founders focus on functional value props, where the real breakthrough comes from understanding the emotional problem underneath. People aren't stressed about note-taking. They're terrified for getting something important and getting in trouble. When you solve the emotional problem, customers just don't use your product, but they'll feel different. And that's where they start telling their friends. And this is what remarkable software companies master. First, they focus on the essence. Then they create something valuable and desirable. And lastly, they master the art of surprise and hitting the right nerve. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's my day saver. to be honest, you feel backed up. You can always go back and have a conversation about what was really said and what's the essence here. That's there's so much more than you create a meeting notes for me. Possibly I don't even look at the meeting notes. It's everything beyond that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because you're also changing behavior from like we used to all dutifully take notes and we clean them up afterwards and review them. And now it's just like I just have the meeting and kind of all the artifacts get created for me. If I meet with you again in 2 weeks, I just pull that meeting back up again, scan the notes, rewatch the important segments. It actually changes, I think, the way you think about, you know, basically memory, right? Memory and recall. And so you kind of end up offloading a lot of the stuff onto the AI so that you just don't, you know, think about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I keep wondering, like, am I using this product well enough? You know, what else can I do with this? And that is a very good sign for a product.
Yeah.
That you're sort of, worried that there's more that you can use from it because it's so powerful. Exactly.
I think the other sign we had is we had a lot of folks that were like, we saw two things in the beginning. One, people were like, I want to pay you for this. I feel bad that I can use these for free, right? Like, I feel like I get so much value. I want to pay you. And we were at them like, no, we love that. That's fine. Like, don't worry about us. Like, we've got a plan. But the other thing is we had to put a whole thing on our website. We had to put, because people were like, also like, this is too good to be true. Like, we had to put a whole thing on our website. Like, how can this be free? People are like, are you selling your data? What are you doing? Like, you know, 10 years of companies being kind of scammy with free products, I think made people rightfully kind of skeptical. So we had to like explain our whole business model on the website at one point because we got this question so often. But I always told our team, I was like, look, this is a good thing, right? People just feel like they're getting so much value. You know, if it does feel too good to be true, that's like a really good sign, even more than any NPS score we'd see.
Yeah, like you say, it's that people are throwing money at you, and you say that you don't have to yet. for what you use it for. I mean, we started this conversation with your point about like the external validation that keeps you up. Well, that gets you out of bed in the morning, doesn't keep you up at night. Maybe if you didn't have it, but I don't think there's a shortage there. Has there been What has been the most unexpected type of feedback that you got from a customer that changed how you look at your own business and potentially even saw more potential behind it?
I mean, I think we saw, I think startups are always a bit of like having good hypotheses and then getting lucky on timing and certain amount of things, right? So there's a certain amount of that. And we got lucky in that Zoom was like launching this marketplace right as we were getting started, and we were able to like join this marketplace. It's very rare you get to be day one at a new marketplace for a giant company like Zoom. And so really appreciative to all the folks at Zoom that helped make that happen. And as a byproduct of that, we've got this kind of viral flywheel of a product, but the biggest challenge with kind of those types of products is how do you get the first 10,000, 50,000 users to get that flywheel in motion? And we got lucky that Zoom had this kind of marketplace that allowed us to get that those first tens of thousands of users. The other thing it did for us is it got us a very really wide spectrum of users. And so I think the thing I was most surprised about when I looked at the feedback, when I saw what was written in, we pay you money to give us feedback after your first meeting. We give you points that turn into raffle tickets to give us feedback in the app. We at some point asked people to like write reviews on sites like G2, which is kind of like a Yelp for software. And when I looked at all the stuff coming in, because we have this whole boom channel where we post all the positive comments, right? Because again, our whole team, not just me, thrives on this external validation. I was surprised by the breadth of usage that I saw, right? I obviously knew my use case as, kind of a, technology professional using this on Zoom, but there was, agencies, there was freelancers, there was therapists, there was PTA meetings, there was just a really, really wide range of people using this in different ways. There were people that were talking, that were using this because they had, oh, I've got ADHD and this really helps me, or I've got this and that. And I was just like really shocked by like, okay. Again, I knew this was bigger than just sales, but I didn't know it was as big as, seemingly everyone in the world. And so that was, I think, really, really fun. It also reminded us that there is a lot of power. Like there is, especially when you build these things, you kind of spread virally rather than, the sales-led growth model, you kind of end up getting a whole bunch of like wide usage of the product. And so I think that informs how we think about always making sure we're building features that can apply to everyone, not just a very specific niche of the customer base or user base.
Having said that, because you touch upon an important topic. I mean, even well, you're a product-led growth company by design, and you get it's a horizontal product, so there's many, multiple hundreds of use cases, possibly thousands. I mean, from a focus perspective in the company, do you have a focus around a particular use case or a particular category of use cases that are more valuable and more critical for you to develop for?
I mean, we knew from the beginning that like we want to make sure we are really good for external meetings, like meetings with customers, prospects, whatnot, because we knew that's, internal meetings are pretty powerful, but the external meetings are where Fathom's going to spread from one company to another and kind of jump right from one company to another. And so that was really important. Also, we saw that those were a lot of the cases where I'd say the kind of the highest density kind of value per meeting minute is how I think about it, right? Like that call of the customer is the one that everyone in the org wants to get access to, or, oh, I'm head of product, I want to know what's being said on these calls. Oh, I'm head of marketing, I know what's being said on these calls. So we intentionally kind of set out to like make sure Fathom was really good for those use cases. And now we're kind of expanding and thinking a lot more about how do we like make Fathom even better for internal meetings, which have like slightly different set of requirements. They all have like the same general set of requirements, but slightly different. So yeah, I think my job, I think as CEO is always to like provide context, capital, and constraints. And so like I'm always trying to bound the box. And so we don't try to like do too many things at once, right? And so in the beginning, like I said, it was like all we cared about was retention. Great, retention's good. Now all we care about is onboarding and activation. Great, that's good. Now we're going to worry about, basically virality. Okay, that's good. Create our monetization. And so always kind of like putting the blinders on the team and saying, we just care about these types of problems right now, I think is honestly super, super important.
That is super important. Glad you say that. It's this. First of all, I mean the breadth of the things that you develop for. But the moment you start doing that, it's the same. Well, that breadth kills R&D. The breadth kills sales, kills marketing. And once you do it slice by slice, do you really do it slice by slice, or do you more do it step by step?
We do it much more like step by step. Yeah. Like
Yeah.
I think most people looked at this business and looked at how horizontal it was and like, you can't possibly serve all these folks well. But we actually looked at it and said, no, actually the use case is similar, right? Whether you're in that PTA meeting or you're a therapist or you actually have the same problem set, right? It doesn't, you wouldn't think so, but you do, right? Where it does get more specific is like, oh, I'm a sales manager versus I'm a head of product. Okay, you have slightly different requirements and things you want out of the product. And so we do now think about this a little bit differently and take it more role by role. But in the beginning, we always took things step by step, like do not pass go. And it has also worked well. Like I kind of fundraise around each step. Like, oh, look how good our engagement rates are. Yeah, we only have like 50 people using it, but those people use it day in, day out. I can fundraise on that. Oh, okay. You know, we don't have any, we haven't monetized yet, but look how good we are at getting new users. And again, we're keeping them because we fixed retention. So I'm a big fan of kind of taking things one step at a time and putting the blinders on and don't worry about, you have to take them in the right order, right? If we monetize first, it's up to your retention first. But if you do it in the right order, I think it's a really powerful methodology.
Do you have a framework for that?
No. If anything, I probably borrowed Dave McClure had this thing back in the day called like R. It was like pirate metrics, but it was like acquisition, activation, I think referral, retention, revenue and retention, right? And so those are like the key things. And I think you just have to look at your business and figure out like what's the right order to tack those in. I think for most folks, it should always be retention first. I think that one's easy. But then you can make a decision
You'd be
about like,
surprised.
yeah, I mean, then you can make a decision about like, oh, is monetization one of our hardest things? Do we need to prove that out early on? I've always been a fan of if you get people using a product day in, day out, you can find a way to monetize at some point. There's
That's
very
true.
few companies that haven't figured that out. But maybe you have a product that doesn't have a natural, you know, the usage pattern is once a month. Okay, you might need to figure out monetization earlier because I think that's risky. But in general, I've always had
Typically,
this
why
belief
are
that,
that? You know, there are the use cases whereby the product can be used, but yeah, if you use it once a month versus every use it 5 times a day, it's a completely different perspective.
different game. Yeah. And so I've also, I have two opinions. One is like, if you can drive a lot of regular usage daily, maybe weekly, you can always generally monetize. Or if your TAM is big enough, you don't care about basically giving it away for free to the first 1,000, 10,000, even 100,000 people because you know, okay, cool. We may never monetize that segment. And that's okay. That segment there to teach us how to build the right product to get us to the right early adopter users. And great, we still have 99% of our team in front of us, right? And so that's why I said to our team, it's like, they're like, what if these people never pay us? I was like, that's totally fine, right? Like that's, again, our TAM is big enough. That's okay.
Well, as long as you can make that the story inside your company that because of the free, you also get the paid, you know, because it very often starts from that perspective. Do you see now that, I mean, if you look forward, and maybe you already see it building up right now, I mean, by definition, a product-led growth company, but do you also have a sales-led motion already?
We do it. So what's kind of interesting is we started off completely PLG pre-product. When we started selling a version of Fathom, we called Team Edition for the first time, it's kind of like an add-on product. We actually were 100% sales-led. You had to talk to a salesperson to sell it. There were two reasons for this. One is like we knew we would learn a lot by having those conversations about like what the product needed to be, what's the right price point for this, all sorts of things. And I actually about a year to 18 months before we started selling, I brought in three of the best salespeople from my previous company. And I said, hey, I want you to come in and be like a CSM, be a customer success person for a year or two. I don't know how long, but like get to know the product, just help customers, just become really knowledgeable, become a product expert. At some point, I'm going to give you something to sell. I've got nothing for you to sell today, but at one point I will, and we'll need you like already ramped up. And that turned out to be true because the second reason we sold that way is it's about or mid 2022. The market shifted and we hadn't planned to monetize for a whole another year and 18 months. Like we were just focused on growth and referral and like we were going to just keep raising money without any revenue. Market shifted and pretty soon it was very, very quickly, it was very clear like you will not raise any more money if you can't prove people will pay for this. And so no matter how much confidence I had in that, investors wanted to see the proof of that. And so we cookies pivoted that team. Like, great, you're now a three-person sales team, you're selling this product. And oh, by the way, we only have like 2 out of the 10 features that are we intended to have in that product already built. So you're kind of selling the roadmap. And going back to kind of customers loving us, I would say that, you know, I think we got 100,000 in ARR that first month and kind of went off from there. And, you know, you're like, how did you sell a product that where you only had 2 out of 10 of the features in the product? And the honest answer is customers just loved us so much. Like most of the people that were buying, right? Look, my whole team uses this. I love it. I'm excited where this is going. But you know, right now I'm really buying this because I want to support you guys because I've got so much value out of it. And so there's that kind of like customer love that coming back to help us as a kind of as a tailwind. So yeah, so we started off 100% sales led on that, and now we're actually moving backwards towards making that, you know, I think we're at 60% going to kind of 80%, 90% PLG. So we kind of, I like to use the sales team. I, you know, we're a PLG company, but I love to have people on staff that can have real human conversations. We invest a lot in customer support. That's all human based. We invest a lot in sales because I kind of believe that we want to, you know, we want to surprise and delight people by saying, hey, we're going to give you a really low cost product, but we're also going to give you high service. We're going to talk to you. We're going to explain the product to you. And I think you usually get one or the other.
Yeah, exactly. It's I recognize it also from products like Superhuman, you know, where I also have been on the phone with someone that explained it, and I could call him again, and it's this delight that yeah, that gets people talking about it.
Yeah, I'm actually friends with the founder of Superhuman, and this idea came from them because I remember talking to them because they had this like, you have to go, you have an onboarding for a $20, $30 a month product. You get a 1 hour onboarding with specialists sort of
Exactly.
thing. And I remember being blown away from it by this. And like, you know, it's kind of cool because it break that's the thing that breaks conventional norms. People would say, every, you know, VP of sales would say, that's just not tenable. They're like, no, we ran the numbers. It's totally tenable. Like, you can totally do this and it creates great outcomes. So I was like, oh, I love that. So.
Yeah, if the product backs up for it, exactly, then it's that's all good. And yeah, the rest is history, because I've been using Superhuman also for at least 4 or 5 years now. I mean, paying for an email client like that is,
Same.
yeah,
It's a fantastic product.
I would miss it if it was gone, you know. That's and that's
Yep.
also with Fathom. So talking about the free part, and that came of course in that era of growth at all costs, you know, just make sure the numbers yeah, go through the fence. But then you had to get to, well, to monetize, and ideally also towards profitability at some point in time. What has been your biggest challenge when it comes to creating this a predictable stream of income? Or wasn't that an issue at all?
Yeah, I'd say it, you know, the biggest challenge was kind of shifting from being almost a one product company to a two product company, right? And so we have to keep making this, you know, individual single player experience great, right? Like, we were still investing in new AI tools for this, and now we're also building this second product as well. I think that was the hardest. I mean, we had a big leg up because we already had this big pool of people already using it, and so our sales process wasn't, we had to convince you to use this product. It's like, oh, you're already using this product. Do you want to unlock just some other features? Like, you don't have to do anything, right? Other than putting your credit card. So I think it, you know, and we started with very small dollar customers, right? Like a, and so, you know, we weren't chasing big deals. And so from the beginning, it's been reasonably predictable. These things are never that, like, never that predictable at small scale, but small customers farming really out of an existing user base made that motion reasonably predictable from the beginning. The hard part was just like balancing, fighting a battle on two fronts now, right? You got to build, you know, every minute we spend working on the single player product is not a minute we're spending on the multiplayer product, and, you know, staffing up and hiring engineers to do that and managing that.
Yeah, funny how you call it. It's like gaming language. There's
I
multiplayer
think a lot
product.
of this is like gaming. Yeah, I get a lot of inspiration from video games.
Yeah, exactly. Now, talking about the predictability, I get that because of the fan base that you've built over time. Now, there's also, of course, this thing that there are multiple tools that do what Fathom does. So how do you go about, first of all, differentiation, but then also kind of growing your moat?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, our moat in the beginning actually is technical on two fronts, right? One is actually the infrastructure we built. And so this is the thing I think most people didn't realize. When we looked at this problem, we said, actually, the AI part's pretty easy. Like, the AI part is, you know, you're going to drop in a good model. You're going to, you know, the hard part is getting a really good output. And so we're going to have a good team that does nothing but focus on, you know, basically bending and twisting various LLMs and building a pipeline to get really good outcome. So one way to differentiate today is, I think every time there's a bake-off of 10, 15, 20 of these things, the output, whether it's the quality of the action items, the quality of the summaries, we see Fathom come out on top almost every time. So one part is like investing in a team that, you know, keeps a really high bar on that quality. On the other side, though, the hardest part actually about building this product is not that. It's actually having it reliably join these meetings and record and work across all the big platforms. And when we saw, you know, 4 years ago, when we started this company, I saw that most of the other competitors had people saying, like, yeah, it works most of the time, right? this kind of product needs to work every time. It can't just work in 80% of your meetings. You're going to come to depend on it. And so the challenging part is this is an undocumented API. You're sending bots to meetings, and there's actually 50 different kind of scenarios if you're building like a test case for how people could join a Zoom meeting, right? Are they the host? They're not the host. They're on the phone. They're on the phone. Da, 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 da. They've got their, like, there's so many permutations of this. And so the hard part was we spent really like, you know, 2 years perfecting this. And the only way to perfect it is just put it in the wild and have a really keen ear to when you hear something go wrong. And so we built our infrastructure for that. There's other startups that basically sold you that infrastructure. Hey, we'll sell you a meeting bot sort of thing. And that's a great way to get started if you want to move fast. But it's a really bad way to get started if you care about cost. And if you're like us and you're trying to not only just give you a really good output, but you're trying to give it to you for free, right? Yeah. Well, if I have a third party in the middle of that that charges me a decent amount of money, I can't possibly give away for free. So the other big difference here we have is we're the only people that run all of our own infrastructure outside of the LLMs. And that allows us a huge advantage economically because we can just, we know that our cost is so much lower than everyone else, which allows us to basically say, we're going to bully all the other competitors by having Falcon's going to set the bar for what you can do on free. And we're going to make a really strong free product. And I think that's a pretty big moat.
That is super strong. I know a couple of companies that do that. The moment they bring their pricing tier down or increase the scope of the free, whatever the angle is there, they still make more money than the competitors. So they just push them out of the market. It becomes, it becomes impossible to survive there. Unless you create something that is, again, radically different again, because this whole thing of better, 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 like you said, I mean, the actions get better, the summary gets better, but what is, people don't even see that, you have to experience it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's always a game that is hard to play. So I like what you said there about the infrastructure that you built and how that is helping you to decide on the rules of the game. I think that is what it's really all about. Now, talking about, building the business, a couple more questions on that. What has been a success factor or a metric that you thought was important in the beginning, but you've completely stopped focusing on because something else became important?
Yeah, there were certain kind of, before we had AI, we had a way for you to basically we're just transcribing the meeting. Instead of having the AI figure things out, we had a way for you to kind of just like flag moments in the meeting while you're on it. Like, oh, that was an interesting comment Don just made. I'm going to click a button. And I think quickly we found that people don't want to do anything else in the meeting, right? They just they don't even want to click a button, right? So over time, we just like stopped tracking that because we're just like, oh, that's not the killer feature. The killer features is actually not we enable you to not take notes, but you had to do a little input to, you don't do a thing. You just get on the meeting and Fathom does the rest. So there's some things like that. We don't track that as much. I'm trying to think what else. I think a lot of it was, I think we go through phases where we get really deep in a certain section and we look at every little, we're debugging the onboarding funnel and we look at every little step in it. And we don't, once we feel good about that, we'll come back to that occasionally and revisit it. But we don't, I think there's just areas where we go really deep in certain sections of the product, right? Whether it was, like I said, in the beginning, we're really deep on like, what are the drivers of retention? What is the activation point? We figure out like, where's the tipping point to really good retention? And then all these things kind of get like, okay, like we have these kind of rules of the road for us, right? We know these things. And so we don't have to go keep a close eye on them constantly, right? We just know this is how this product and business functions.
Exactly. Anything around the business metrics, NRR, but also, for example, ARR per employee, are there any things that you have started to focus on more than others?
I think we go through different seasons, right? Where we're focused on different things. We actually have, we focus a lot on that NRR number now for our team mission product. I didn't worry about it in the beginning because I was kind of like, not a good product yet, right? Like in the beginning, it was like, 2 features out of 10 on the roadmap. Now that we've really filled out that product, okay, the real test of that product is NRR, right? I tend to look at like gross churn, honestly, as much as NRR, because I think for products like us, there's a natural like expansion, like really strong expansion motion. And sometimes you can have it be so good that it kind of blurs the fact that like, oh yeah, your gross retention can be not that great, but it's, if you just look at NRR, you won't notice it. Thankfully, both of ours are good, but I care a lot about like, why are we, I, I'm hyper competitive. It's like another trait. I hate to lose any deal. So like I look at our t sales team's win rate and they're like, we lose even one deal, let's talk about it. We lose one customer, let's talk about it. And so I think we focus a lot on just any of these gross numbers where we like, where were we not the right person? Because we want to give, we think Fathom should be a no-brainer. We should be like, from a price perspective, from a functionality perspective, from a, you know, risk perspective, like you should be like, this is an easy decision to go with Fathom. And if it wasn't, there's something really, really important for us to learn there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's about getting feedback again, right? That is, of course, your background, you know, the feedback tab on the website. What did you take from building that company that has really helped you to get things going faster at Fathom?
I think it is that, you know, thinking about building those feedback loops from day one, right? And not taking it for granted. I think a lot of people will take for granted that, like, oh yeah, of course someone will give us feedback. And it's like, no, actually most people won't, because most people don't think you care. Like they'd love to tell you how your product would be better if they thought you were actually going to do anything with it. And if they cared about you and your team, right? Like, you know. So I think what helped a lot is what I always said at User Voice was running that company, to tell customers, like, you should not be afraid of feedback. You should be afraid of apathy, right? I'd rather have someone angry at me than hear nothing. Because anger generally comes from like, I want this to be better. I was excited about it and it didn't live up to it. And you can turn that around. It's really hard to turn around. We ask for feedback, we don't hear from anyone because just no one cares about the product. Like, and so,
True.
you know, I think that's, don't be afraid of people being frustrated with your product. That's actually, it's not the best sign, but it's not the worst sign either, right? Like there's possibilities there.
Exactly. There's at least upside, and there's a good sign of, but yeah, like you say, people like it and want it to succeed, for whatever reason.
I actually think getting feedback is like, I call it like the vegetables of startups, right? Everyone says they're getting feedback. Everyone says they want feedback. It's not true. It's actually not fun to get feedback. Let's be honest, right? Like you can only generally find out your baby's ugly by getting feedback, right? And most people don't, you know, don't have the fortitude, like subconsciously don't want to deal with that, right? They don't want to hear that it's bad. Or if they get feedback, they kind of like really focus on the good stuff and won't, I don't know, I'm kind of a broken human. Like I want to read all the bad feedback. I love that, you know, the good stuff gets me out of bed in the morning, but like hearing bad feedback and be like, that's what gets me like fired up. I'm like, okay, we failed this person. We got to go fix this. I'm going to get on the phone with them. I'm going to talk to them and tell them we're going to make this better. And da, da, da. And so that's where the real gold is. You got to look into people saying terrible things about your baby and calling it ugly. And you got to just take it and take it to heart. So I think it's a really hard thing to do. And I don't think it's acknowledged enough that that's not an easy thing to be open to.
Yeah, I think it's a disease to walk around it. You know, it's this complacency feeling. Like, how can they say this about us? We have the best product. Yeah, they're just stupid. No, it's not. Yeah, it's very often the beginning of the end. Okay, looking at the time, one question from your experience now from 2007 onwards to now, like almost 20 years in entrepreneurship. What would you provide as a do and a don't to other tech entrepreneurs that, yeah, aspire a similar journey that you have done?
I'm very fortunate to like fall into a group of entrepreneurs about 20 years ago who were fantastic. Like I was worked in the first batch of Y Combinator, and so got to see just like amazing operators build amazing businesses. And I would say the thing that I saw the most successful people do is really trust their own gut. From an early age, before they seemingly had any right to trust their gut that much, their own intuition on things, and not be afraid to do things just the way that made sense to them, not whatever the latest, you know, thing out there was. Oh, you know, like Superhuman's a good example, right? Like doing something like, no, we're going to have people do 30-minute onboardings with every customer, right? Like having the guts to say, we're going to do this, even though every VC would probably say, that's not how companies do it, right? And so just finding a way to do it your way and what makes sense to you, I think is super important, because that's how you get kind of differentiation, is you do things differently. You do things the way that makes sense to you, not just what it seems like everyone else is doing. And so that is the number one thing. You know, I think I've learned this lesson now, but it took me 10, 15 years to figure out like, oh, I should stop trying to build everyone else's startup and I should try to build my own. So that would be the number one thing. Don't be afraid.
Good. Perfect. Thank you very much for sharing this. Thank you very much for sharing the whole, yeah, so many nuggets of the journey, and particularly the parts that actually helps you, yeah, build this remarkable product, because it is. So where can people go to find out more about Fathom or to say hi to you?
You can find Fathom or fathom.video. You sign up for free, and you can find me on LinkedIn, Richard White on LinkedIn. So yeah, reach out to me on me if you get any feedback.
Good. Well, thank you very much. I'll keep following you every day because I'm using the product. I'm a big fan, and I recommend people to check it out themselves if they're not using it. So good luck in the next section of the journey.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. This is a lot of fun.
And this wraps up my conversation with Richard White, CEO of Fathom. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Ton. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.